Nathaniel X Weeks Commander Q.
36 Jesuífe Commander Q.
36 X Weeks Commander Q. 3.
On Spirit and on Radio, on Broadcast, Broadcast the World, the World, on Radio, on Radio.com, Tony, and the Web, on Radio, on Radio.com, for sharing the archive and more.
Thank you. been a strange year. They arrived at the season of lights again. Many of us who were here for the last one, I guess you could say, are here in a different way this go around. They're part of the spaceship again. But many did not die old, and many of the old ones did not die well. Now, our best and brightest are starting to pass around medicines that will be shared all around this spaceship for better travels and better days. So a kind word and a touch of the heart for this spaceship and its many inhabitants, for all those moments when we are grateful down to our very bones, and all those many moments when we are not. Look up into the sky today and think to yourself, what a wonderful way to travel through the universe at amazing speeds on an amazing spaceship. None know hand or paw that wrought, but whoever or whatever wrought this spaceship, this green and golden and rainbow-colored spaceship, thank you. We are the grateful trace of that which made us, and thank you, and thank you. And we will be grateful for the medicines that heal and protect our bodies, and we will try for the harder ones too, the medicines for our hearts and the medicines for our souls, grateful ever of this beautiful spaceship long traveling the universe. Thank you, and thank you, and thank you again.
August 25th, 1999, 1:25 p.m. How many miles from the border?
What time is it?
Approaching the Indiana state line, still in Ohio, approaching Indiana.
Really necessary to tell us the one that I got us last? Oh, no.
the road.
Oh. East 90 to 80 to 94. Is that what it says? I'm reading it wrong.
Yes. East 90 to 80 and to 94. So we'll go east 90 to 80. So we actually are backtracking this whole
quick way.
Okay. Past 1,000. Well, we could have actually gone west on 90 and gone kind of across. But we can't be that far off because when you took that picture, the sign picture, was it 90 or 80? Did it register?
It didn't.
But it can't be that far off.
No. What, 94 and 80? 94 and 80 are the same road for a while, and I think what it's going to do, this is what I think it's going to do. I think it's going to give us a little piece of 65. This is what I think it's going to do. I want to take this little piece of road that's going to connect us to the 94-80, and we'll just take that. Let's see if I got this right. Okay. We're going east. We're going this way. And for a night's sleep, I dreamt about Barbara and I dreamt about Mio. Barbara I worked with at some company. And she was giving me some money, and I went into her safe for some reason, forgot to lock it, or thought I forgot to lock it, and later someone blew it open and ripped off everything, and it was really upsetting. And in the other one, Mio and I were on a kind of a Canal Street Malden that looked like it was in Cambridge. And she was helping me pick up girls, which was most nice, most gentlemanly of her.
You must have locked the safe, because otherwise they wouldn't have needed to blow it open.
Well, it wasn't like, I don't know if it was quite blown up, but it was as though it was possible it had either been broken into, or I'd left the door open and they just like ruffled through it and like just like ripping things out trying to find the money or something. Anyway, after that, we got up and while Mio packed the car, I packaged up Burning Man books for all the various and sundry people here and there, all the friends scattered everywhere. We're going to get Burning Man books before the Burning Man people of Burning Man do, or about the same time anyway. And some cynicals and some scripture press samplers and some chapbooks. Whole big arm heap full of that. And, we took off and found a rest stop and mailed off all the packages and got some hot dogs and we've been driving through cornfields. Well, not through cornfields, like between cornfields. We're driving on the road that goes passes through cornfields, or however you put it, for a while now, and it's probably going to be like this for quite a while.
Forever.
Corn belt, right?
Getting to the end of it.
Just arriving to the corn belt. And later on today, I'm going to take the wheel for the first time in the trip. As the roads have gotten, they're not as hilly, they're straight for the most part. The exits are few and far between, the weather is reasonable, and it's still daylight, so all the factors necessary are there. And Mew is enjoying the modern benefits of cruise control today for the first time on the trip. And I must say, getting off all the cynicals and I packaged up the radio show tape for John Murphy to play on Radio Free Cambridge. So that's all done. And thank goodness for that, because the next one doesn't have to be done until for a week now. The first one had to be done within the first couple of days of the trip. The next one, I'll get a full 7 days to sort of come up with it. So the pressure's a little bit lower next time around.
And you know what the time factor is to assemble it.
Right, right. We also won't be traveling by the time it takes on. You know, on a rush from the next one to the next. So we're passing through farmland, farm country. Seeing corn, cabbage, fruit trees. What else?
Flowers.
Flower beds.
We just passed a field that was a seed farm. They were growing, whatever they were growing, they were going to harvest the seeds and package them.
Oh, okay. It's pretty flat country. Buildings are old and weather-beaten for the most part, though occasionally we come to an area, a city area, where, like near Toledo, the buildings got modern and close together, but for the most part, you have buildings that have probably stood for a long, long time, and are probably most of them still functioning in the way they functioned for decades. Because my childhood was spent pretty close to farmland, I feel somewhat of a native attachment to this kind of geography, to land put to this kind of use. Where I grew up in Connecticut, Bloomfield, when I was a kid, the towns thereabouts all had tobacco fields, and one of the jobs that you could get back in that time, one of the few jobs you could get if you were a teenager under 18, the working age was different back then, was picking tobacco. You could get a job picking tobacco under the legal working age. I'm not sure why or how that worked, but it did. Maybe they just didn't check or whatever. Maybe the economy just needed people to pick, and that was that. So anyway, it's good to be recording again. I just spent the better part of 2 hours overall putting the Within radio broadcast onto this journal, fixing it to its place in this journal. So it's good to be back in the present tense for a while. The weather is sunny. Well, somewhat sunny. It's partly cloudy, but there is definitely sun. It's warm. It's nice. It's nice, beautiful weather. It's good for driving and picturesque landscapes. And I think it's going to go on like this for a while, so. I guess that's it for now. More later. Oh, P.S. to, previous entry, a postscript to it. We are approaching the Indiana motorway. I noted it before, approaching the border to Indiana. But I figured I'd record it. Yes?
Are you
going to
try and photograph the sign?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Didn't I do that before?
Can you think about the double?
Oh, yeah. I guess it just got away from me, didn't it? But we're still 4 miles from the border, even this toll booth is here now.
We must be 2 miles when we get to the toll booth.
And 7:45 p.m. or so. Still August 25th, 1999. Lincoln Oasis Rest Area. Food court. Just over the state line from Indiana, where we were, to Illinois, where we are now. Well, it's been quite an afternoon, and I haven't had a chance to record up to this point because of it. I drove shortly after the last entry for all of about 40 miles, probably not even that much. It went okay. I made little errors, but no accident and no major blunders, and that's good. That was back in Indiana that I drove, so I've now driven in Maine, Massachusetts, and Indiana, amusingly enough. Then after that, there was a stop for ice cream, and after that, there was a stop at a place called Yellow Brick Road in Indiana, a Wizard of Oz shop, full of all sorts of trinkets and memorabilia, and a fantasy museum, which was this back room you can get into for a quarter to see all these sort of handmade Wizard of Oz interpretations, big stuffed dolls and paintings, and even a glass case miniature display of the Yellow Brick Road. It was, I think, 4 glass cases. It was delightful. I took lots of pictures. Unfortunately, it was raining, so the figures that were outside, the full-size Tin Woodman and the Lullaby League, the little girls from the movie, who sing in high voices, I took pictures of them, but it was not like I was standing right near them. But it was fun. It was fun. It was a neat thing. I bought a little pendant of Dorothy holding her basket. That was really neat. I'm going to put that on a necklace and wear that. She wanted to go home, and so do I. And she went looking for her home, and so am I. And ultimately, she found her home in the Emerald City, not Kansas. But she brought her people to the Emerald City. So there's something in her story that I feel is similar to mine, and perhaps part of her story that I haven't yet followed through yet, part of the parallel. After we hit some bad weather, some hard rain for a while, and then we got lost briefly. It wasn't that bad a mishap. It was just a little bit, and it was just enough to slow things down. And then we got held up, delayed at the border into Illinois. Toll booths, lots of tractor trailer trucks trying to get in. So it wasn't that bad, but it was annoying for a while there. It was just a sequence of events that slowed us down. But we made it through and across the line, and now are into Illinois and planning to do some steady driving for the next 2 or 3 hours to try to get through Illinois and over into Iowa, just over the border. There are some hotels, there's a cluster of hotels just over the Iowa border that look pretty good. So we're gonna go for that if we can. The food court we're in, it could be in a mall somewhere. It's a large room with lots of tables and chairs and fast food stands and little areas clustered around its edges. Snack bar. We've been getting lottery tickets for Mark Charette. That's kind of a gag. We've gotten him an Illinois one, an Indiana one. What tickets have we gotten from Mark so far? We've got Illinois, Indiana,
started in Ohio, I think. Or was it Pennsylvania?
Ohio.
It was Ohio then, so it's Pennsylvania.
And we've done three so far.
Yeah.
So now we're about to send him his third lottery ticket from his third different Midwest state. And we'll keep following it through as long as they play lottery and they have lottery machines in rest areas like this. Anyway, so pushing on, and Mio just converted a penny that she put into a strange little machine from a normal penny into a beautiful little stamped, what would you call it?
Medallion?
What?
A medallion.
Into a medallion of Chicago. This used to be a penny. And now on the back it's, you can barely see the Lincoln Memorial on the back, very faintly, but mostly it's just smooth. And the coin, which was round, is now oval. And the front is a stamped kind of etching of the skyline of Chicago. It's very, very neat. Very neat. It is neat. Only 50 cents. 51 cents, actually, because you give up a penny in the offing, two quarters for the service, and one penny, which the machine uses to do it for you. So anyway, I think that is probably it from the Lincoln Oasis snack bar. I mean, rest area, excuse me. It's about 8 o'clock. We're going to push on and find a cheap hotel to stay at just over the line into Iowa if our luck holds, and I think it shall. So, that's it for now.
X-Wiz Commander Q.
36 XWIF Commander Q.
36 XWIF Commander Q. Train.
And Spirit Long Radio Long Podcast Broadcast The World
36 XWIF Commander Q.
Long Radio Long Radio.com. Tune in and the web and the web.
We're now about 50 miles from the Iowa border. Is that right? 50 miles from the Iowa border. It's 10:13 p.m. August 25th, 1999. The roads are fairly clear. They're mildly traveled. It's dark, but it appears there's flatness on both sides. just stopped at a rest stop to play at a playground. And it reminds me of a story. And this may be apocryphal. But back at Bloomfield Middle School, the last time I was truly happy, there were many games we played back then. Sportsmanship was highly valued. Swings, dodgeball, football. And I remember one glorious winter, we had something called the Snow Patrol. Back of our school was basically the playground. The playground was blacktop. And there was one winter where there were heavy snows, and the snows would pile up on the blacktop, and they would get in snow clearing trucks to plow the snow clear of the playground. And they would end up in hills that would surround... Have I told you this story? That would surround the playground. There'd be these long hills. Can you picture that?
Yeah.
Because they're like shoved the snow, so formed a perimeter. Into mounds, yeah, that's it. That's what I was looking for. Large mounds of snow. And so naturally the kids would completely abandon the playground, which the snow shovel people had gone to the trouble of clearing for them, and spend all of their time on the mounds, which were far more interesting because they were different. The playground was there all year. Well, it seemed as though some people, some kids, would get to the top of the mounds and shove other kids down off the mounds. So some of us enterprising young kids, not so much because we were... good deed doers, but because it was a cool idea, formed the Snow Patrol to police the kids who would shove other kids down the mounds. And I don't know how long it lasted or whether it worked very well, but it was a really cool idea to do that, to form a Snow Patrol. Anyway, the apocryphal story, or the possibly apocryphal story, has to do with the swings. There were certain swingers amongst us who were better than the rest. There were certain swinging champions. And there was a story of one swing champion who, it is said, swung so high in the air that the swing went over the top bar and came down the other side, and he hung on. So he did a 360.
Wow.
I'm not really sure. It wasn't me. I wasn't a championship swinger. I wasn't really a championship anything at sports. I was always sort of in the middle, or more toward the bottom. Like that thing where you had to climb the rope?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I couldn't climb it a single notch.
Me either.
I couldn't climb it a single notch. I don't know how I got out of it, but I just couldn't do it. I was pretty good at volleyball, though. I was good at volleyball. So anyway, what that has to do with driving through Iowa-Illinois border country, I really don't know. But all I know, we were playing on the swings, and we were playing on the seesaw, which some people know as teeter-totters, and neither one of us had been on a seesaw/teeter-totter probably since either one of us was kids, because you don't see seesaws too much in public playgrounds. Which reminds me of another story of the playground that was near my childhood home, which I believe was called Pershing Park. Pershing Park was a really wonderful park. It was a full-blown park. You had a baseball field, a basketball court, and then there was this... then there was this building where all sorts of sports and recreational equipment was kept, and it was large enough such that there was an area of it where there were picnic tables and places to sit under out of the sun. And I remember making a lanyard there one time for a keychain, and we would play checkers there and chess and various board games. And that's where we would go to get balls out of there were people in charge who would, in the summer, allow us to use the very sports equipment that they had on hand. Pershing Park was really wonderful. It was really great. And it was through Pershing Park, which I guess must have been part of the Bloomfield Park and Recreation Service, Bloomfield, Connecticut. It was through Pershing Park that I ended up going out into nature. One of the few times I was brought out into nature and taught anything about it as a kid. There were these field trips we took out to these day camps thereabouts in central Connecticut, and were taught various things about nature. And I remember I was about 10 years old, and I had a crush on this little blonde girl who would wear a Boston Red Sox baseball cap. And she had really short blonde hair, which would not be to my taste now, but was completely my taste then. And she looked like such a tomboy. There was something so endearing about her, because she was obviously a girl, but she dressed completely like a tomboy. And something about that to my little prepubescent pubes was a real turn-on. But I learned about black-eyed Susans and Queen Anne's lace, which are wildflowers, and are the only two flowers in the world of whose names I am assured. I am assured. But those were good years, the playground scene there. The funny thing is, about 10 years ago, I went back there with some friends who indulged me and drove me back to my childhood home, because I really wanted to see what the neighborhood looked like. I hadn't seen it since my family moved out in 77, which at that point was 12 years earlier than that. It would now be 22 years ago. And the lot that we would play football in was overgrown with fields and weeds and looked very disused, as opposed to when we played there, where we stomped down all the weeds and so they never grew very high. The park looked as though it had seen better days. It was kind of locked off, and I don't even know if it was really the same kind of parks and recreation thing that it had been. The whole thing seemed like it had gone downhill between 77 and 89, which is too bad. But the other thing about Pershing Park was that it had a merry-go-round. It had a really, really good merry-go-round. You know, not like on the horses and shit, but the round thing where you hang on.
Right.
You run in the dirt, and you get it going real fast, and then you hop on.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was such a great merry-go-round. Oh.
Those are great.
Oh, those are great. And it had a huge slide. I mean, a really tall slide. I mean, we were all short kids, so let's say we're 4 feet tall, and it was still huge. It must have been like 12 or 15 feet high. And it was silver. And sometimes when the kids would get bored of sliding down it, we would start at the bottom and climb up it. And you'd have to, like, brace your feet against either side in order to have leverage and gain your footing, because the slide wouldn't go down in a nice angle. It had a little hump in the middle. So you'd go down, and then you go whoomp. And so what you had to do is you had to, and it was very slippery. It was a very slippery metallic slide. So that was really neat. So it had a good merry-go-round, excellent swings, really high swings. Very high swings. The higher the swing and the longer the chains or the ropes that hang from the top cross beam of the swing, the higher in the air you're going to be able to get. So it had good swings, good merry-go-round, good slide, a baseball field, a basketball court. The black kids were all into basketball. I was never much into basketball. And the place, the recreation place where we played the games and learned crafts. Oh my God, I remember learning how to, there were these things you made. I guess mostly what you made with them, if you were, didn't know much about them, is you made, baking, not mitts, but like,
The loops.
The woven loops that were elastic-y.
Yeah.
And you'd weave them in and out, and you'd have lots of different colors. And so I'd make those, and I'd make lanyards. Oh, and I remember making wallets. Oh, God, this is flooding back. I remember making wallets. They were leather wallets, and how would the key part was to take the cord or whatever it was and loop it in and out of the borders to close it. wallets and different kinds of items that of that kind. I remember playing Battleship at that place. Battleship is a great game. You play Battleship?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was other parks. I mean, it was a system. It was not just one park. It was a number of systems that were for different neighborhoods in Bloomfield. This park was, I would walk down Jackson Road. My family lived at 13 Jackson Road. And it would be about a half a street of that, and then a turn left onto another street, and then there was a corner that I came to, across the corner, and proceeded, and the park was behind a fence. I feel like I'm under self-hypnosis, I'm remembering all this stuff. And the funny thing was is that it was the kind of neighborhood where you knew pretty much every neighbor. I mean, it was houses. You know, I haven't lived in a house in, since 1985, so that's 14 years of living in apartments. And I haven't lived in a house I liked since 1977. In a neighborhood that I cared about. It's been 22 years since I lived in a neighborhood I really liked. And I really liked my neighborhood. I mean, I knew a lot of people in it. I knew all the families up and down the block. There were people I didn't like. There were people I was enemies with. But I always look back on those times and I can't fault them. There was nothing wrong with them. I have no complaints. I was happy. I ran wild, and I was good in school, and I didn't have any problems in school. The funny thing is I had my school friends, and I had my neighborhood friends, and the two of them really didn't cross. The school friends were white, and the neighborhood friends were black, and I don't know why, but I didn't hang around with the neighborhood friends at school much, and I didn't bring the school friends home much. But once in a while I did. This was in the mid-70s. And at the time I really didn't know anything. I didn't have any sense of history. I didn't understand I didn't understand in 1974 that I didn't know anything about impeachment hearings. I mean, I didn't understand what Watergate was. I knew that it was something other than the soap operas that were usually on TV, and it looked boring, but I didn't know what it meant. And I remember watching CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, and he would talk about Vietnam. I especially remember 75. He would talk about Vietnam every night on the news, and he always looked very concerned and sad. And he always talked about the troops nearing Saigon. And I remember being sad too. It seemed like something that was really important and something terrible. But I didn't know that U.S. troops had withdrawn already from that war, and that essentially they, by withdrawing, they had conceded the war to the North Vietnamese. And I didn't know what Watergate was. And I didn't know that I didn't know anything about civil rights or white-black conflicts. because in my world, in the world of childhood, everything was blunt. Girls had to prove they were cool, but if they did, then they were part of things. But they never were quite part of things. But they could be part of things if they insisted and made a big fuss about it. And, but no one held it against them. They were just girls, that's all. And the boys were boys. It was kind of a mutual feeling. You're not us, and we're not you. But we're all more or less better than them, the grown-ups, who are our real enemy. I mean, they're the ones that set the curfews and make us come home and punish us and don't give us money for silly things that we want. So it was more children against parents than boys against girls. And it certainly wasn't black against white at all. There was nothing of that until a certain point. And then when my friends approached adolescence, I think their families started talking about maybe injustices that they had been received, and the kids started becoming aware of racial things. Perhaps they started being treated not simply as children, but as maturing black individuals. Toward the end of the time my family lived in Bloomfield, it wasn't any fun. It wasn't really as much fun as it had been. It was more black against white, and my family was the last white family just about to move out of the general neighborhood. All the others had left, and that was unfortunate. And God, you know, we moved to this town called Newington, which I will despise to my dying breath as the most reprehensible, racist, materialist, selfish town I've ever been in. A complete white suburban hell with an overcrowded high school and nosy neighbors, and it matched nothing, and none of that was nothing compared to the turmoil inside my own four walls. But all my parents thought was, all they said to me was, we're moving to a white neighborhood. They didn't say to me, we're moving to a neighborhood which isn't so, in which the people there are not so subject to crime, are not in danger. They said, we're moving to a white neighborhood. They made a big fucking deal about that. You know, it wasn't a better neighborhood. It wasn't even a better house. We moved to a smaller, crappier house than the one we had, which was really nice. And I think I've always resented them for saying we're moving to a white neighborhood, because for the next 7 years, I suffered so much awfulness in this supposedly improved situation, this white neighborhood. I mean, it was white, that was true, but the improvement implied in them talking about it was not there. I was never happy there, not for a single day. Not with the neighbors. I did do one thing that was good. I knew these kids who had this yard, and we'd play baseball in their yard, and I think we played wiffle ball probably. It wasn't that big a yard. But at some point I told them we wanted to give a name to the yard. Like, it's a little park, it should have a name. Ballparks have names, that's what we all knew. Every baseball team's park has a name. So I called their yard, their little park yard, Fenway Yard, and they really liked that. That was a triumph. That was a good moment. But I was never happy there. And the funny thing is, my parents live there still. They've been living there for 22 years. That's longer than either one of them has ever lived in any home previously. And they'll probably grow old and die there. Okay, I want to read Heinlein. It's either read Heinlein or jump out the car. Jump out of the car.
Don't jump out of the car, it's allowed.
Okay, well. Since it's now banned, they can't do it. I could have done it before when it's still legal.
Kind of like, it was never legal. It's simply not posted.
Kind of like LSD. Authorities find out how much fun it is, they ban it. Okay. Authority.
Oh God, are you joining with Rick who always tells me you're one of them?
You're one of them. You're not one of them. It's one of them.
Yeah, he thinks I'm one of them. Those management types.
Oh. What would he know? Oh, thank you. This is from Robert Heinlein. Time Enough for Love, DeCapo. Tell another story now, but I think I'm just going to read this. I just had an image of a guy who worked at Quantum Books whose name was Chris. We called him Christo. He was the strangest man I'd ever worked with just about, and I've worked with some strange people in my life. He was in his 40s. He lived on Beacon Street in Boston, and he was working at this crappy bookstore job, which was completely unaccountable. And he had many strange habits. He was probably in his 40s, short hair, always dressed impeccably for a bookstore. Very neat dressing man. And kind of had an old face, kind of a sad, low voice. And he had this obsession with various kinds of things. For example, he insisted that everything he eat be white. He wouldn't eat chocolate pudding. He would only eat vanilla pudding or vanilla cake or, you know, he everything he ate had to be white. Right. And he had this obsession with time in which he could only eat at like 4:58 or 5:02. He could only eat at certain times. He had to always eat at those times. And he was a physical, like, he couldn't haul books around on the hand truck. We put one book on a hand truck, one box of books on a hand truck, and he just collapsed under the weight. But I do recall, and it went ever against, completely against his reputation there, so no one would quite take it seriously. But I told at the time he and I were at a trade show at the Heinz Convention Center in Boston, and we had to haul a lot of boxes of books out of the trade area, down elevators, through the lobby, so on and so forth. There was a lot of grunt work. And he was a real trooper. He was obviously straining and stressing, but he hung in there with me. And he even kept a sense of humor. I think he knew I liked him. And that helped a lot. And the funny thing was that one time I was with him at a trade show, and in fact it was early on in our working relationship. We went to this trade show it was at a hotel near the theater district, and we pull up in the store's van, you know, one of those family van things. And he got a bellboy to come down with one of those silvery kind of things that they haul suitcases on. And we piled the boxes of books on one of those and moved it up to the second floor where the trade show was. And he gave the guy a tip. He gave him like a $10 tip. It was the funniest thing. And He'd been in the publishing business and apparently had a kind of a nervous breakdown, so that's why he wasn't working in, that's why he was working a crappy bookstore job instead of a decently paying publishing job. But that was Chris. I think he ultimately disappeared. I don't know what became of him. Oh, it just flashed through my mind suddenly. I looked at the word da capo and I thought of Christo. Oh, and his knees would... No, the manager, Victor, who could be very funny and very snobbish depending on his mood, would always talk when he wasn't around. He said, you know, his knees never bend. It was an obsession. And have you ever seen him bend his knees? He doesn't bend his knees. And he talked about it for days, weeks. It was bizarre. Da capo, 4, home. 27 March 1917, Gregorian. Beloved family, repeat a basic message. I got here 3 years ago, 3 years too early, 2 August 1916, but still wish to be picked up exactly 10 years after drop, 2 August 1926. Repeat, 6. Rendezvous points and alternatives from basic date as before. Please impress on Dora that this results from bad data I gave her and is not her fault. I'm having a marvelous time. I got my business cleaned up and then got in touch with my first family by looking up my grandfather, Ira Johnson, Ira, and got acquainted with him first, and with the aid of a horrendous lie and a most fortunate family resemblance, Grandpa's convinced that I am an unregistered son of his deceased brother. I didn't suggest this, it's his own idea. Consequently, it's solid, and now I'm a long-lost cousin in my first home. Not living there, but welcome, which is nice. Let me give a rundown on the family, since all of you are descended from three of them, Gramp, Mama, and Woody. Gramp is described in that junk Justin has been cutting down to size. No changes, Justin, save that instead of being 2 meters tall, and carved out of granite, Gramp is almost exactly my size. I'm spending every minute with him that he will let me, which usually means playing chess with him several times a week. Mama, take Laz and Laura and add 5 kilos in the best places, then add 15 T-years and a big slug of dignity. Quit quivering your goddamn chins. Add hair down to her waist, but always coiled up on top. I don't actually know what Mama does look like other than her head and her hands because of the curious custom here of wearing clothing all over at all times. And I do mean all over. I know that Mama has slender ankles because I once caught a glimpse, but I would never dare stare at them. Grandpa would toss me out of the house. Papa, he is away now. I had forgotten what he looks like. I had forgotten all their faces except Gramp, who uses the same face I do. But I've seen pictures of Papa, and he looks a little bit like President Teddy Roosevelt. That's Theodore, Athene, not Franklin, in case you have a picture in your gizzards. Nancy, Laz and Laura, as of 3 standard years before I left. Not as many freckles, and very dignified, except when it slips. She is acutely aware of young males, and I think Grandpa's urging Mama to tell her about the Howard setup at once, so that she'll be sure to marry in the families. Carol, Laz and Laura again, but 2 years younger than Nancy. She is as interested in boys as Nancy, but frustrated. Mama has her on a short leash. Quivers her chin, but Mama ignores. So that makes Nancy how old? Laz and Laura as of 3 standard years before I left, so that's 3 years younger than Laz and Laura, who are how old? Yeah, it's a standard timeline age for a woman.
I think that...
So Nancy's
17 or 18.
Okay.
Carol's... Is
15?
Yeah, I think Nancy's 17.
Brian Jr. Dark hair, looks more like Papa. Rising young capitalist. Has a newspaper route which he combines with lighting gas street lamps. Has a contract to deliver advertising handbills for the local moving picture theater, which he farms out to his younger brother and 4 other boys, and pays them in tickets to the theater, and keeps some for his own use, and sells the rest at a discount, 4 cents instead of 5 at school, has a vending bar for soda pop, a sweet bubbly drink, on the corner in the summers, but plans to franchise this to his younger brother this coming summer. He has another enterprise lined up. As I recall, Brian got quite rich quite young. Let me explain something about our family. They are prosperous by here and now standards, but do not show it except that they live in a large house in a good neighborhood. Not only is Papa a successful businessman, but also this is a time when the Howard Endowment of Babies is substantial in terms of buying power, and Mama has had 8 already. To all of you, being a Howard means a genetic heritage and a tradition, but here and now, it means cash money for babies, a stock breeding scheme, and we are the stock. I think Papa must be investing the money Mama makes by having Howard babies. They certainly are not spending it, and this accords with my own dim memories. I don't know what was done for my siblings, but I received getting started money when I first married, money I had not expected, and which had nothing to do with the Howard endowments my first wife earned by being fertile and willing. Since I married during an economic stalemate, this made a big difference. Back to the kids. The boys not only do work, they have to work, or they have nothing but clothes and food. The girls receive very small cash allowances, but are required to do housework and to help with the younger children. This is because it is very difficult for a girl to earn money in this society, but a boy who will get out and try has endless opportunities. This will change before the century is over, but in 1917 it is true. All the Smith kids work at home. Mama hires a laundress one day a week, that's all. But a boy or girl who finds outside cash money work is relieved house work to that extent. Nor does he have to pay back this time off. He keeps what he earns and spends it or saves it, the latter being encouraged by Papa matching such savings. If you think that Papa and Mama are intentionally making money grubbers of their offspring, you are right. George, 10 years old, Brian Jr.'s junior partner, shadow and stooge. This will end in a few years with George busting Brian one in the mouth. Marie, 8 and a freckled tomboy. Mama is having a difficult time trying to make a lady of her, but Mama's gentle stubbornness and biology will win. Marie grew up to be the beauty of the family, with bows underfoot, and I hated them, as there had been a period when I was her pet. Marie was the only one of my siblings I was close to. It is possible to be lonely in a large family, and I was, except for Gramp, always, and Marie for a short time. Woodrow Wilson Smith, still short of 5 by several months, and as offensive a brat as it was ever allowed to grow up. I am appalled to be forced to admit that this stinking little snot is the weed from which grew up to be the humanity's fairest flower, namely old Buddy Boy himself. So far he has spat in my hat when it was presumably out of his reach on the cloak rack in the hall, referred to me with various disparagements of which, here's the dude in the derby again, is the mildest, kicked me in the stomach when I tried to pick him up. My error, I didn't want to touch him, but thought I should break myself of irrational queasiness. And accused me of cheating at chess when in fact he was cheating. He called my attention to something out the window, then moved my queen one square, and I caught him at it and called him on it, and so on, ad nauseum. But I continue to play chess with him because A, I am determined to get along with all my first family for the short time I will be here, and B, Woody will play chess at any opportunity, and Gramp and I are the only chess players around who will put up with his poisonous ways. Gramp clobbers him as necessary. I have no such privilege. But if I were not afraid to find out what would happen, I might strangle him. What would happen? Would half of human history disappear and the rest be changed beyond recognition? No, paradox is a null word. The fact that I am here proves that I will keep my temper long enough to get shut of this little beast. Richard, 3 and as affectionate as Woody is difficult, likes to sit on my lap and be told stories. His favorite is about 2 red-headed twins named Laz and Lore who fly a magic airship through the sky. I feel a tender sadness about Dickie, for he will, that is, did die quite young, assaulting a place called Iwo Jima. Ethel, a heavenly smile at one end and a wet diaper at the other, short on conversation. That's our family in 1917. I expect to stay in KC until Papa returns, soon now, then leave. Some of this is a strain on me, pleasant as most of it is. I may look them up when this war is over, but probably not. I don't want to crowd my welcome. To make the above clear, I should explain some of the customs here. Until Papa gets home, my status has to be through Gramp as a friend he plays chess with. It can't be anything else, even though he and perhaps Mama believe that I am Uncle Ned's son. What?
There was just a sign that said 80 west. I think it said 80 west 2 miles, so I think there's an exit. You know what we're talking about?
Yeah, the right-hand turn.
Yeah, so I want you to see the next sign and just verify that I'm reading it right.
Okay.
And here is the next sign. Oh.
Use
west. All right, that's not the next sign, because we're not actually going to the point.
Okay.
Or we're not aiming for it.
Well, the next sign is coming up now. Right. Yeah, it is.
Not so if you're going to photograph me a sign, you're going to want to do it soon.
Didn't I already do that?
You know, I don't think so.
Yeah, one, okay, I'll have to get one of these, can I get one of these green signs? Or you want me to get one of the highway signs?
Any sign you want. Your project. I'm just reminding you.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, thank you. How many miles do we have left?
I think 9.
Well, I have 1.5 more pages.
Okay.
Ned's son. Why? Because I'm a young bachelor, and by the local rules, a married woman cannot have a young bachelor as a friend, particularly when her husband is out of town. The taboo is so firm, I daren't even give the appearance of violating it, on Mama's account. Nor would she encourage me to. Nor would Gramp permit it. So I'm welcome in my own home only if I go there to see Gramp. If I telephone, I must ask for him, and so on. Oh, it's permissible on a rainy day for me to offer a ride home to members of the Smith family at church. I'm permitted to do almost anything for the kids as long as I don't spoil them, in quotes, which Mama defines as spending much more than 5 cents on one of them. Last Saturday, I was allowed to take 6 of them on a picnic in my automobile carriage. I am teaching Brian to operate it. My interest in the kids is considered understandable by Mama and by Grant because of my, quote, lonely, unquote, and, quote, deprived, end quote, childhood as a, quote, orphan, end quote. The one thing I must never do is to be alone with Mama. I don't go inside my own home unless publicly accompanied by Gramp. The neighbors would notice. I'm meticulous about it. I wouldn't risk causing Mama trouble with a tribal taboo. I'm writing this at my apartment on a printing machine you would not believe, and must stop in order to take it downtown and photo-reduce it twice, then etch it and laminate it and seal it for delay mail and deliver it to a drop, which kills a whole day as I must use a rented lab and destroy intermediate stages as they go. This is not something I dare leave in an apartment to which a janitor has a key. When I get back from South America, I'll make my own lab set up, one I can carry in an automobile. Paved roads will be more common this coming decade, and I expect to travel that way. But I want to continue sending these letters and buy as many delay mail drops as possible and hope that at least one will last through the centuries and reach you. As Justin put it, the real problem is to get one to last through just the coming 3 centuries. I'll keep trying. All my love to all of you, Lazarus. End of chapter. Well, that's good. I keep plowing through that. I'll tell you exactly how many pages I have left. I'm on 496, and I have 90 pages left. Wow, I guess I'm closer than I thought, but I'm not, like, not right there. Just close. Okay, we're nearing the Iowa border. How many miles left?
9
miles from the Iowa border. So I guess, let's see, is this tape going to make it? It should make it. If you drive faster, it'll make it. Just kidding. I'm going to turn it off for now and hold it in my hand and hopefully remember to turn it on when we cross the border. By the way, our mileage at this point is 1,235 miles. 1 mile from the Iowa border. Approaching 1,250 miles. We're going to be crossing a river that takes us from Illinois into Iowa.
Mississippi River.
I don't think so.
It says right there.
It's not the Mississippi.
It's not on that side.
It's not.
Well, then.
It's like you gotta take that exit to get to the Mississippi. Oh. Maybe it is the Mississippi.
Oh, maybe that's what it is. Take that exit to the Mississippi River.
Think it is the Mississippi? I don't know. Maybe I misread that. But I didn't think that the thing looked very wide, and it didn't look to be going more
I think
south.
It says up here.
Yeah. Buffalo Bill Museum. Oh, there's some motels. I don't know if those are the ones we wanted, but
the parade was cheap. I've never stayed in one, but it's supposed to be good. It's supposed to be cheap.
11
o'clock.
What does it say, welcome to Iowa? Unless it was that Iowa Welcome Center welcomes you, and I got that. All right, we're here.
Okay. How about if we look in the book and see what's coming up?
Okay. Are you done taking pictures for a moment?
I guess so.
All right, more later.
Commander Q.
36 Jesuíf Commander Q.
36 Jesuíf Commander Q. Train.
And Spirit and all radio, long broadcast, broadcast the world.
36 X with Commander Q.
Radio.com. Tune in and meet the web at long radio, long radio.com. Share with Archiven and more.
Sun, behold the sun, great God, sun still riseth in our Rubaiyat, and strikes the towers with a shaft of light. The sun still rules everything, even the sky as we know it, even love as we know it.
And the sun the sun, my visible father, making my body visible through my own eyes.
I'm waiting for Voznesensky to turn on with us and speak love tonight. And I'm waiting for Aphrodite to grow live arms at a final disarmament conference. And I'm waiting for our iron comrades to attend in a new rebirth of wonder. And I'm waiting for Voznesensky to answer. And I'm waiting for Neruda to answer. And I am perpetually awaiting a rebirth of wonder. Why are you so puritanical, comrade, kicking Allen Ginsberg out of Czechoslovakia? Americans love travel. We love exotic places and people. We dig Chinese chicks, we dig Cuban chicks, we dig Arab boys. You'll think ours are exotic too. And blessed be the fruit of transpopulation with no more nations. Hosanna Pulchrissima, Kyrie Hallelujah, we'll all still have the sun in which to recognize ourselves at last across the world, over the obscene boundaries.
Why fight it? Fight for that, for you, and her, and he. Fight for all humanity. Not in fascinated fear, as moths fight the light, as though the atom were the monster, when it's we who have the power to see. or cloud the universe, a new flower, if we keep it on a human scale, combat the darkness loud, drown the doom-boom flight of bombers' night, unmourned mortality of a mushroom shroud.
Mutation of the spirit. What make of day? Quickly into tunnels I run, huddling there, a tremble, eyes darting how and where. Last night, a white apple fell from the loneliest tree in the world. Today, the field is green, the sun bright and warm. Children attend their spirits, the old knit. Chicken cries, sacramental sobs from the chapel, a window closes, loneliness, grandeur and blue lambs, world eyes, rinsed light, swimming deer, and now the long hike back to the city, smells of rats and pasty poisons, horizons of fuming domes, dynamos, vast sixth sense, smudge pots, gasping black smoke, cheesecloth faces, dead carts, bells, a white arm, a long pale arm falls across the port. Days and days of snow, starched air, nurses, children, navies. I would communion go. Oh, come nights of fire. I can't face the stiff, blanched day. Ah, dark, bad fire, ah, still the day. Blacken useless destruction, all remains. I shan't go out, sit in my room in my gloom and laugh out my night. Dawn, I smiled at the rooster and walked into the day. Sun, sun, sun. Knelt and heavened a child again, praying to an ignored flower, sun and green, cows and brook. Black is fat, is thick, is deep, is drink, death and sleep, and white is thin, is a losing man, a slouched old woman. The field is green, the sun is bright, old men with wide pants hold twisted belts, and children attend their spirits. The vision was peace, oh how silly I was in that scene. Ether sirens and lights and loud numbers, unborn ages, wriggling shapes and cowls. Yesterday has become a century away, meager valor of historic years away. Who rings this piteous surrender of the spirit like a wet towel? Don't say. That's it.
It was my spiderhood, a whole new mythology, a cavern full of wicked sisters, a whole new breed of them mutated by this new hallucinogenic vitamin which I hereby christen Spiritlect, the vitamin which has made the intellect get up and look. A couple of hefty spider sisters brush past, lugging in other dead academicians.
Come, man, come!
Want to come up?
Come!
Yeah, okay. The text.
Read the text. Read it to see my thinking notes.
Yeah, that was... Hey, you're a lovable idiot, you know, really. No, I mean, the reading of this poem has already been f***ed up, so, you know, I...
Read it more!
Well, read it! Okay, right, you know... Who's... No. So, now we're all in here at last together. And even you, the darker sister of them all, though I know there's backstairs knowledge and, of course, we're all specialists in something. And yet how far back can this guild keep going into that tunnel which is your bravery, Alan, and which all our voices echo suddenly, sinisterly? Oh, happy light bulb, still so patiently preaching your doctrines, indoctrinating your systems. Light bulbania, light bulbania. Why couldn't I realize this is where I always really lived? Sorry, Alex, I'm not reading anymore. I'm reading the last appeal. No, I don't care. I've got one short poem, which is finally going to be the
ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, hold on. This evening is an experiment, and we're finding out about just what happens when we put 5,000 people in a hall with a few poets trying to be natural. Now, hold on. Harry Fainlight wants to read one more poem, one very short one. And I think that he should be allowed to do so.
No. This poem is just essential to this reading. It's called Lark Song. I'm sorry. It's called Lark Song. It's about the lark. No, it's about the lark. Right. Fresh wildernesses. Resurrected from the raw broken concrete at the airfield's edge, where mounting from the coursing grasses, a lark's fistful of blood and feathers flings its song into the teeth of the wind and drops back broken. O bursting minstrel heart pounding amidst those thrashing grasses, yet but once more rise, climb, O shine out emblematically against that ceaseless silver, soaring and settling, yea, even to where the giant rocket ship is standing, balanced upon its own exhaust blast, terrible, O sing, ecstatic, unshaken by that heart-shaking, cathartic roar. That's the lark. That's...
Okay, pretty and plain.
Let me say something about that poem.
It's a great thing. Harry doesn't feel he's done himself justice. He wants to explain a little something about the poem, but I explained to him that it's a damn fine poem, and we really don't need to know any more about it. Not at the moment, anyway.
Concern. I was run over by the truth one day. Ever since the accident, I've walked this way. So stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. Heard the alarm clock screaming with pain. Couldn't find myself, so I went back to sleep again. So fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. Every time I shut my eyes, all I see is flames. Made a marble phone book, carved all the names. So coat my eyes with butter, fill my ears with silver, stick my legs in plaster, tell me lies about Vietnam. I smell something burning, Hope it's just my brains. They're only dropping peppermints and daisy chains. So stuff my nose with garlic, coat my eyes with butter, fill my ears with silver, stick my legs in plaster, tell me lies about Vietnam. Where were you at the time of the crime? Down by the cenotaph, drinking slime. So chain my tongue with whiskey, stuff my nose with garlic, coat my eyes with butter, fill my ears with silver, stick my legs in plaster, tell me lies about Vietnam. You put your bombers in, you put your conscience out, you take the human being and you twist it all about. So scrub my skin with women, chain my tongue with whiskey, stuff my nose with garlic, fill my ears with silver, stick my legs in plaster, tell me lies about Vietnam. Love poem, entitled Stunted Sonnet. Love is like a cigarette. The bigger the drag, the more you get.
So, in the evening, man sits by the fire he has tamed, on the ground he makes fertile. Outside, his creature, the horse, that ran wild before he came. Oh, clever man. And men have grown inside themselves, minds that move further and faster than light or the changing air, and speech men invented to trap the mind as it flew, and so to hand things down. And above all, we have learned the intricate civilities of government, how to avoid unhealthy places, and how to escape from the wind and the rain into cities of slate and ivory. But even as we make, no matter how much we make and whatever we make, we long to destroy the thing we have made. Finding no enemies, we become our own enemy. As we trap the horse, so we trap other men. But the others strike back, trap closing on trap. Having eaten enough, man must next build a wall around whatever food is left, and other men must pull down that wall. So the roof gets split, and the rain and the changing air wash away whatever is left of man and his cities when man has done with them.
When I write, I have trouble with my tenses. Where I was tomorrow is where I am today, where I would be yesterday. I have a horror of committing fraud. It is all very difficult, the past even more than the future, for the latter is at least probable, calculable, while the former is beyond the range of experiment. As the ghosts rise upwards over the grave wall, I re-coffin them neatly and bury them. It is, I suppose, my last will and testament, although insofar as I have a choice in the matter, I shall not be dying for a long time. One can only cultivate oneself as one awaits the issue. If eternity were available beyond death, if I could be as certain of it at this moment as I am sure of the fix I have only to move my hand to obtain, I should in effect have achieved it already, for I should be already beyond the pitiless onslaught of time, beyond the constant disintegration of the present, beyond all the problematic struts and viaducts with which prudence seeks to bridge the chasm of anxiety, with the ability to say, avoiding unseemly haste, I'll die tomorrow, without bothering to intend it or not to intend it, as bravely as the fabled gladiators of ancient Rome.
Schim schan flank war das Wort, schund das Wort war bleib flott, schund flott war das Wort, schund das Wort schist Fleisch geblorden, schund schat schunter schunst geblont. Schim schan schlank schar das Wort, schlund scha schwort schar schleisch schlott, schund flott war das Wort, schund scha schwort schist Fleisch geschlorden, schund schat schlunter schlunst geschlont. Schlutsch, flotsch. Grrt, grrt, grrt. Zinkrum, zinkrum, Leppen, Leppen, EO, 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 na, 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 Poleon, 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 na, Poleon, Poleon, na, Poleon, Poleon, na, Poleon, 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 na, 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 Poleon. The last, to end up with, a poem by one of the fathers of sound poetry, Kurt Schwitters, Fury of Sneezing. To miles of magnetic tape and endless red tongue snaked round a big spool. I have been taken apart, dismantled, and dragged to interrogations. No, I've been back for months and all alive. No, I've been home for months, but not all of me. Somewhere beyond the seas, spies in their spinach tint suits are watching the movies unwind with owlish x-ray stares there on the screen. Boom, light on the couch. You sit smiling at me and stretching your arms, and he couldn't make it. One of them grunting, one of them groaning out, what a chick. The hunchback stares somber through one purple eye. Does it hurt, Mr. Wozniak-Sensky?
Let go, you creep, let go, Quasimodo. My soul is burning and bleeding in the glare of liberty's cleaved lights, the tender, wet stares of their bloodhounds. Andre, would you like to read? Oh, now I have to read the bad poetry. The chain. I will now read poems which you have not seen published. I have to read slowly that he will understand. It will come out of the mouth of the pilot, the dry-lipped diplomat, the hairy teacher will come out of me again, shitting the meat out of my ears on my cancer deathbed. Oh, crying man, crying woman, crying gorilla shopkeeper, crying dysentery bone face on the urinal street of the self. Oh, Negro beaten in the eye in my home. Oh, black magicians in white skin robes, boiling the stomachs of your children that you do not die, but shudder in your serpent and worm shape forever. Hail to your horrible desire for godly pride. My heaven's gate will not be closed until we enter all human shapes. All trembling donkeys and apes, all lovers turned to ghosts, all acres on trains and taxicab bodies sped away from date with desire, all movies, all which was refused, all which was rejected, the leper sexed hungry of Nazi conventions, hollow cheek. Arab Marxists of Akko, crusaders dying of starvation in the Holy Land. Oh, thin Bengali sadhus adoring Kali Mother, hung with nightmare skulls. Oh, myself under your pounding feet. Yes! I am that worm soul under the heel of the deep. I am that man trembling to die in vomit and trance in bamboo eternities, belly ripped open by red hands of courteous Chinaman kids. Come sweetly now back to myself. As I was.
Quiet! Kabir says this: I am a mass of sores and worms. I am false name. The prey of Yamantaka, devourer of strange dreams, the prey of radiation and the prey of police hells of the law. I am that I am. I am the man and the atom of hair in my loins. This is my spirit and physical shape. I inhabit this universe. Oh, weeping what is against my own nature for now. Come, sweet, lonely spirit, back to your body. Come, great God, back to your only image. Come to your many eyes and breath. Come through thought and motion, up all your arms, the great gesture of peace and acceptance. Abhaya Mudra, Mudra of Fearlessness, Mudra of Elephant Calm, and War Fear ended forever. The war on man, the war on woman, the ghost assembled armies vanish in their realms. In Russia, the young poets rise to kiss the soul of the revolution. In Vietnam, the body is burned to show the truth of only the body. In Kremlin and White House, the schemers draw back weeping from their schemes. In my train seat, I renounce my power so that I do live. I will die. Over for now the vomit, invisible skull, the fear of bones, the grasp against man and woman and babe. From this single birth reborn that I am to be, so my own identity now nameless, neither man nor poet nor dragon nor god, but the dreaming me under physical stars with tender red moons in my belly, and the sun, my visible father, making my body visible through my own eyes. Alex, give me a limit. Alex, Toki, does anybody have the time? It's 11:15. Whoa. Oh, well then I'll read one poem. I read one poem left, if I can find my book. No, I have a big long... I have my book. I've lost my poetry book.
X-Wiz Commander Q.
36 XUIF Commander Q.
36 XUIF Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right,
Thank you.